It is a pleasure to introduce our next instructor based in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Glenn Surowick founded GDS Investments in 2012. From 2001 to 2012, he worked for Alcyon Capital Management as an equity research analyst, co-portfolio manager, and portfolio manager. Before joining ACM, Glenn worked for Enron as a derivatives structuring manager and for Commerce Bancorp, now TD Bank, as a real estate credit analyst. Glenn has a BA in management, accounting concentration from Gettysburg College, and an MBA finance concentration from Southern Methodist University. Our members will be very familiar with Glenn by now. He has been a true mentor and a great contributor to our community. And it's always such a great pleasure to have a chance to speak with Glenn and get his latest perspective on investing. So on behalf of the MY Global membership community, a very warm welcome to you, Glenn.
John, thanks for that generous introduction. Always glad to participate in the Best Ideas Conference, and thank you for hosting it, and thank you for having me.
And Glenn, we're also avid followers of your writings, which are available on your website at gdsinvestments.com. So we may touch on some topics from your mid-year letter and some other topics. Perhaps we could just start with the moment in the markets and investing right now. So speaking kind of end of 2019, beginning of 2020, it seems like we might be at somewhat of an inflection point here. Talk to us a little bit about how you see that.
Well, I think from where I'm sitting, I see, obviously, I think what's interesting about 2009 is that, you know, the expensive and large stocks have done, you know, quite a bit better than cheap and small. And you know, that margin is around 25%. And, you know, I think really it's an extension of what happened and what's really been going on over the last 5+ years, where there's this huge divergence between value and momentum. And I think kind of the last period that is similar, sort of at least directionally, is the late 90s. I think that investors need to understand that, you know, the S&P has essentially gone straight up for the last 10 years. And I think if you look at, you know, history, when this has happened before, it certainly sets up poorly for the ensuing decade. And I think if you go back to the period that I mentioned, late 90s, so, you know, the S&P back in March of 2000 was at 1550. And 7.5 years later, it was at 1550. And this is, you know, before 2008, 2009. So in October of 2007, you know, essentially it was flat. Now, you know, it lost 50, it went up, it recovered, it did this, that, and the other. But, you know, it wasn't sort of this buy and hold vehicle. And so obviously, like, you know, the idea of being tactical as it relates to any investment is critical, depending on valuation. And I think we're kind of coming off a period where, you know, there was systemic undervaluation in 2009, you know, and so a buy and hold framework was very, very relevant and very lucrative. And I think that, you know, the next 10 years, I think people are going to have to be a little more tactical. And I do think that lends itself to more of a stock picking strategy. And I think, you know, just people need a healthy dose of realism. You know, we bottom ticked in March of 2009, you know, in the 730, 740, 750 area on the S&P, and today we're at 3200. So, you know, I think that people just need to take a step back and look at kind of what's happened over the last 10 years. I would say that, and I've commented about this before, I think there's a little bit of, I don't know if bubble is the right word. I think complacency is the right word as it relates to kind of passive and active investing. I think at the end of the day, you know, if you are a passive investor, terrific. And if it's working, terrific. You know, but people need to take a perspective that passive investing, it's only as good as the underlying investment. So to the extent that the underlying investments are under overvalued, obviously that's going to drive your rate of return. And I think some of that discussion has been lost, you know, in this 10-year cycle where passive has done better than active. And I think that, you know, there's strengths and weaknesses with both strategy, and certainly, you know, passive is a low cost producer, and that, you know, at the margin is a good thing, but if it's what it's producing at a low cost is overvalued, then that's going to be the driver of your return. And I think that people, you know, have a tendency to just think that if they're putting things on autopilot, and if they're ignoring valuation, and I think what's particularly troubling is, you know, 10 years ago, there was less than a trillion tied up in passive strategies, back when passive strategies was so, you know, it was such a systemically cheap way of making money, right? And now that it isn't, at least based on what I see, you know, now it's at $4.5 trillion. So the average dollar, you know, which shouldn't be a surprise to your community, the average dollar is obviously doing the opposite of what it should, given where underlying valuations are. So, and I would say the last sort of inflection point, at least, you know, really important piece that I think investors at least should have on their radar, you know, is what's happening in the bond market. And I, you know, certainly I see this within the data, but also comes out in conversations, and there's enormous amount of complacency. There's a lot of money that's tied up in, you know, negative yielding bonds. And so, you know, you've had this sort of borrower lender relationship that's flipped upside down. And, you know, the bond cycle has been very, very long and very pronounced. And it's, you know, we're essentially on a four decade bull market. And when that happens, you essentially have an entire generation that doesn't really understand the underlying risk. And I think that bonds are universally tagged as safe without consideration to, you know, changes in interest rates, because that's never really been, that hasn't been an issue for so long. And so technically speaking, yes. I mean, in terms of maybe credit, yes, I get how, you know, maybe a 10-year at 1.8 might be, quote, safe. But when you factor in interest rates, you know, I don't view a lot of the money tied up in the bond market as, you know, very, very safe, especially things that have a longer duration. So, you know, I think that those are the opportunities. Those are the red flags. And I think the investors that kind of get the next cycle right are going to do quite well. And I think ones that, you know, obviously are tied into maybe some of these areas that have gotten extended over the last decade, I think are going to be for, you know, quite a shock.
Just to unpack a couple of things there, Glenn, I'd be curious for your take on passive. It's had a huge run, obviously, in terms of assets under management that have moved into passive. Passive sort of rides on top of the real function of capital markets, which is to allocate capital to productive uses. And do you have a view on the ratio of passive to active that's needed to preserve the capital allocation function of markets? Because presumably if everything went to passive, there would be, that function would break down.
In terms of putting that into a number, I don't think we know. I think right now we're sort of at a 50-50 split. And I don't know what the magical number is. I do know that the reason we got here is so Passive has done well because it originated from a really, really good spot. So Passive, the value of passive investing goes up when you have systemic undervaluation. So when there's lots of sectors that are undervalued, and when momentum is stronger than value, then passive sort of, you know, obviously it reweights based on what's done well, not what's going to do well. And so it has a, you know, it sort of has a snowball effect. It's a really, really interesting question, and I don't know, because it's such a new area, in that I don't know how we know, like, no one really knows how this is going to play out. You know, I think there's investors like myself, and certainly Seth Klarman and Dr. Burry, that have been very, very vocal about the excess that's building in passive investing. And in some ways, I think that, you know, Warren Buffett has maybe been thrown into the other category, probably. I think his point is well taken. I don't know that, you know, I would rather sort of follow his approach that he's actually practiced, and the approach that he's used to generate a lot of his wealth. I mean, I know that he's got $150 billion and none of it is passively managed. So to me, that speaks a more powerful message than maybe anything that people are trying to read in between certain things that he might say kind of at an annual meeting or whatever, and, you know, things like that. But I you know, from a personal standpoint, I don't have anything for or against any underlying strategy. I'm sort of wed to the idea of buying discounted businesses, and to the extent that you could do it in a fund, either active or passive, you know, terrific. And to the extent that that fund is cheap, you know, terrific. But I think when people start drinking the Kool-Aid and they think that buying an S&P is somehow a one-way ticket to wealth creation without any regard to underlying valuation, you know, then I think that people need to just maybe kind of reset their expectations, and, you know, really understand that it's just like anything else. It owns assets, and to the extent that the majority of those assets are weighted in overvalued companies, that's a really bad thing. And so the fact that you're paying 20 basis points for it is sort of irrelevant at that point. Yeah, it is what it is. But, you know, you raise an interesting point. I mean, I think that I don't have a good answer to that. I think that I think we'll find out. My guess is that there's a cyclical phenomenon within a secular phenomenon. And but my guess is that if you sort of look at, you know, previous behavior, when there's this huge reallocation toward these vehicles, it's typically a little bit too late, and it sort of looks like the end of a very long cycle. And so, you know, I kind of go with what Joel Greenblatt recently said in a Wall Street Journal interview, which is, you know, buying the cheapest stock still works. The S&P is expensive. Buying the cheapest stocks in the S&P will do a lot better over the next decade. And so that's kind of where I stand.
So there are a few things that are tough for us fundamentally oriented investors to understand, or that might be at an inflection point. You alluded to them. So one being value versus momentum, and how those types of equities have performed, another active versus passive, another the level of interest rates and how much money is invested at zero or below. Do you have any take on what might actually make this an inflection point, how this might change or unravel, because it's been going on for a long enough time that a lot of people kind of dismiss it out of hand if you say, well, inflation might come back. Any take on what might actually cause this to start going the other way?
I think withdrawing monetary and fiscal policy will allow markets to act in a more normalized way. Politically, it's a very difficult thing to do. And I think that that'll be a start. I also think that the normal business cycle will be a start. I think, you know, at the end of the day, our economy works in cycles. And so I think when the economy slows, I think people will kind of, you know, take a harder look at paying, you know, 35X for a business that's growing at 8. Regardless of underlying quality. And so I think those two things will get people to really take a harder look at valuation. And I'm not, you know this, but just for your listeners, you know, I have a very open mind, or maybe a new age view of valuation. I mean, I'm not looking to buy like low price to book or low PE or, you know, things like that, maybe on a normalized basis. I'm a value investor, but I'm one that leans heavily toward quality, whether it's, you know, quality in terms of growth and quality in terms of, you know, business and return on equity, or quality in terms of management. I want to pay a price that makes sense, and a price that makes sense in all environments. And inflation has a weird way of just happening and catching people off guard. I would say that, I think that if you withdraw the amount of support and just how prolonged it is, a little unprecedented. And so I think if some of that's taken away, then I think that I think rates will naturally want to move higher. And I think that, you know, the second piece of that is just the normal business cycle. I don't see the business cycle gone away, but if our economy slows, then I do think that people will revisit what they're paying for certain businesses. And I think that's starting to happen a little bit, at least based on, you know, what was this sort of disconnect between, you know, what private market values, how they bid up certain businesses that turned out to be, I think public investors didn't really see eye to eye. And so when this company went public, whether it was Lyft or Uber, or even like, you know, WeWork and that debacle, not to pick on SoftBank, but just, you know, I think that people are starting to really kind of wake up. And, you've kind of seen this in the IPO market, which has been good from a listing and a liquidity standpoint, but bad in terms of, you know, how it's rewarded some of these unicorns. So that's probably a first step into that. Okay, you know, this isn't just the public markets are kind of wising up to how certain businesses should be priced.
Shifting gears a little bit, in your mid-year letter, you talked about China and some of the issues around trade, but you also mentioned a company that you had invested in, Baidu. Can you elaborate a little bit on your rationale there and whether you still feel the same way?
It's still a position. I kind of take the Charlie Munger view of China. China is a wonderful story, and I think the way I've got exposure to that area is trying to take best of breed. And I think, you know, Baidu in terms of search, in terms of, in terms of some of their other assets, I think they are extremely well positioned over the next decade. So it's a position. I think there's a little bit of leap when, you know, you talk about the Alibabas or the BYDs and the Baidus, but to the extent I'm going to get, you know, maybe more direct exposure to that area, I think that I'd rather go with, you know, companies that have some size, that have, you know, sizable moats, and, you know, companies that have real, real established businesses.
And it sounds like you feel pretty secure in terms of your ownership and the governance the unlikely scenario that the Chinese government will take steps to affect the value of the holding for at least Western investors.
I am. I mean, so my quote China exposure is, so Alibaba is a decent sized position, but I think if you kind of bundle them all up, I think you're looking at about 15% of the portfolio. But yeah, there's a little bit of leap, but yes, I think China has sort of embraced globalization and capitalism, and not by Western standards, but nor do they have our history. So I think directionally they're certainly moving in the same, they're closer to the same place that we are today. Is it happening at the pace that everyone's comfortable with? Probably not. But they're investable companies. They're real companies. And I think they have very long runways too. And, you know, I think when you look at these companies and you look at how they're run and you look at leadership and so does the government have a role in society? Of course they do. But I'm not sure I think ultimately these companies will be impacted not by the role of government. I think they'll be impacted by decisions they make and what's kind of controllable internally. Maybe that's too glass half full, but that's my perspective.
That's helpful. Thank you. Another stock or investment you've talked about in the past, including in this forum, is General Electric. It looks like that turnaround is proceeding, perhaps a little more slowly than some might have liked. What's your take, and do you still see it on track?
Yeah, so she, I think long term, and I think when I originally talked about it, I think it was in the 2018 Best Ideas Conference, and I still own it, and you know I'm certainly patient with turnarounds, and you know I've had a lot of success with companies like Bank of America that you know for whatever reason. You think it's going to work out a lot quicker and it doesn't. And, you know, next thing you know, it doubles in 6 months. I think there are so many good things that are happening. And, you know, it's exciting on many different levels. And, you know, certainly Larry Culp, I think, is bringing in just kind of a really new, upbeat perspective. I think he's certainly very candid about what's going on. He's got a great track record at Danaher between, you know, 2000 and 2014. I think he really understands the whole capital allocation mindset. And, you know, he has kind of called 2019 a reset year. He's delivered on everything that he set out to do. And in most cases, he's exceeded his original expectations. They are on target for almost $40 billion in asset sales by early 2020. At a recent Morgan Stanley conference, which I think was in September, he had said that the power business was improving both on the margin and demand side. And, you know, I think turning around power obviously will continue to give them a significant lift, and all indications are that power is improving. It's coming off a trough. And, you know, I think other issues about, you know, just, you know, obviously aviation is performing well. Healthcare is performing well. Fixed costs in the power business are down 10%. So it's sort of set up for margin improvement once demand picks back up. And, you know, in terms of, you know, meeting his industrial debt goals, which he laid out, which don't quote me on this, but I think they went into the year maybe at like $50 billion. And I think he's on target to bring that down below 30 in the next quarter. So I actually think once the industrial leverage continues to come down, and the fact that they are going to, I think, from a cost standpoint and operational standpoint, I actually think that at some point this will turn into a sort of a stabilization turnaround story to one that, you know, I think ultimately they're going to be in a position to play offense. And I think that, you know, what really messed GE up, putting it mildly, is this huge decade-long, and even longer, I mean, it was more like a decade and a half of just capital misallocation, where you know, they just seemed to kind of double down on businesses that were on the cusp of declining. And, you know, that it, when you're making big bets and those bets, I mean, this is sort of like a different version of SoftBank, and those bets go wrong, and you're, you know, maybe at the same time buying back stock or taking on a leverage, it only compounds the problem. And so I think that Larry Culp certainly recognized that. And I think he's cleaning that up. I think he's taking steps to, you know, delever. He's getting out of businesses that weren't, you know, quite core, whether it was, you know, Baker Hughes, GE, which he unwinds, or even, you know, Biopharma, which helped him kind of get the leverage ratio down. Or even the locomotive business, and with you know, the transaction he did with Wabtec. At some point, this will be a business that's now in a position to say, okay, you know, they didn't bring him in just, you know, just to kind of execute the first leg of this. I think really what he has done at Danaher is it's really on the M&A side, and he's been able to kind of really take on a lot of, you know, accretive acquisitions, build up businesses, and subsequently spin those off. And I think the next leg very well will resemble that period. And I think they're in a great position. So I'm you know, certainly at, you know, 11 and change, I'm not looking to sell, and you know, I'm certainly happy with how the first year has gone for Larry Culp. And, you know, the stock, I think, is starting to kind of build up momentum in terms of, you know, the investment community, and it's attracted, you know, people like Duquesne and Stanley Druckenmiller, and, you know, recently Ken Langone made some positive comments about it. But I think that, I think that the GE board, by bringing on Larry Culp full time and taking him from a board role to a management role, I think was absolutely critical. And, I couldn't be happier with where they are and what's happening and where they're going.
Another investment is DowDuPont, where you had a position before the voluntary breakup of the company. And I believe you sold one of the three entities post-breakup, Dow. What's your view on DuPont and Corteva, the other two entities?
So I sold Dow and I sold Corteva. And there was no real, I had other better businesses. I still own DuPont, and you know, Ed Breen is very closely aligned with DuPont. I've done very well with Ed Breen in the past, and you know, he's very similar to Larry Culp in terms of how he thinks about building up businesses and the kinds of businesses that he wants to be in. And if you listen to the last call, I mean, he's quoted as saying, we're well aware of the value creation potential inherent in the portfolio. And he's actively pursuing, you know, different strategic transactions that are going to drive shareholder value and, you know, increase returns and create growth and things like that. So I think he's very much kind of cut from that mindset, where bigger isn't better, you know, let's be focused, let's get, you know, sort of, let's allow businesses that aren't necessarily, that shouldn't be connected, let's let them kind of live on their own. And he's done that, but I do think that just like Tyco, I think we have kind of have another layer of that coming. And yesterday there was news that, you know, they combined, they merged their nutrition business with IFF International Flavors and Fragrances. And it valued the company, it was $26 billion in equity, but the enterprise value was $45 billion. But DuPont will own 55% of it and have board control, but they're going to keep IFF CEO. In addition, they'll get a $7.3 billion dividend payment at the time of closing. So, and it was a non-taxable event, not to get overly like technical, but it was done kind of through this reverse Morris trust, which is kind of this, it's a sort of this M&A structure used to kind of bring different assets together, in a tax efficient way. But just, you know, he's a guy who's created value in the past, you know, and I'm very much into the jockey, and he will have a role at both companies, and so I still like DuPont. I mean, I think if you know here we are. It's funny you mentioned those two names because, you know, here we are at all time highs, and you know, to my point earlier about, you know, there's sort of things that are happening at 10,000 feet, and then there's things that are kind of happening at ground zero. And at ground zero, you know, GE is close to a, you know, several, at least, you know, 5-year low, you know, if not more. You know, I know it's bounced off or whatever, but, you know, you look at American Airlines or Dow DuPont or, you know, Molson or, you know, Gilead Sciences, all these companies, but that, you know, they're all, they haven't done anything in the last couple of years, despite the fact that they've kind of reconfigured their portfolio. And in some ways, you know, they are so much, and the new, it's funny how you know, people were sour, not sour, but people were, the original comments on the transaction was that it might take a year to close. And that kind of gets back to my earlier point about just the lack of patience that people have in the environment. So if people love the deal, but it's going to take a year to close, you know, that basically takes 90% of the investors off the table. Because they don't want to wait a year. They're renters and not owners. But you know, it's a great transaction. They got a premium price. They had two bidders, and they got the highest bid, and they still retain control, and they still at every level. Ed Breen's still going to be involved, and they got a $7.3 billion in cash out of it. And you know, the market cap is 45 billion. And if the worst thing that analysts can say about the deal is that it's going to take a year to close, well, that's fine. You know, it's just kind of the environment we live in. And I see a lot of short-sighted behavior. And frankly, you know, I was sitting down having lunch with a prospective client, and they said, well, kind of walk through your strategy. And then, you know, before I got into how I go about looking at ideas, I said the simplest way I can describe my strategy is that I'm trying to arbitrage the difference between stock prices, which tend to move in a very, very wide range, and business value, which just, you know, operates in a much more narrow range. And he understood this because he was an ex-business owner. And he said, yeah, I mean, my business, you know, we have an equity plan that's tied to business value, and you know, it sort of goes maybe up 5% a year kind of thing, you know, and then through that, you know, we kind of price grants off that. And I said, well, that's kind of how most businesses operate, whether they're private or public. I mean, you know, business value doesn't change a whole lot year to year. But I said, well, why don't you go look at some of the companies I'm looking at? And so I named a couple of the companies, and I said, look at a 52-week high and low. I said, you're looking at a 50% difference, and it's ridiculous. And I said, you know, unfortunately, this is kind of like the great thing about the stock market, is that if you can just accept the fact that in the short term, it's there to provide liquidity, but it's not necessarily a great pricer of assets, if you will, but in the long term it is, then if you understand that basic concept, you're going to do quite well.
And Glenn, where are you fishing for new ideas these days? I ask because the companies we just talked about, they're fairly large, well-known companies. And at the same time, it seems like small caps right now are at a fairly big discount to larger caps. Is that a place you're looking for ideas?
It is. I mean, I'm sort of market cap agnostic. I mean, I would say that the one asterisk I'll put next to that is, so I run a separately managed account business, and I own 15 to 20 positions. And most of my assets are individuals and family. So there's a level of small cap exposure that the average individual can tolerate, if you will. You know, because of the inherent greater volatility associated with that. Certainly the opportunity set in small caps has expanded. And so, you know, I've certainly tilted the portfolio toward that. That's not lost on me. You know, it's, I don't know what quote, you know, but back 20 years ago, people used to define small caps as 1 billion and less. You know, obviously, I would say now maybe it's 5 billion and less, you know, just by the fact that, you know, here we are just 20 years later. I there are several companies that are sub 5 billion that I own. And, you know, there are several in that 5 to 20. And then, you know, I obviously, the ones that we've mentioned on this call have just, you know, they just so happen to be, you know, DuPont, which is, you know, 45-ish, GE, which is approaching 100 billion, Baidu, which is actually less than people think. It's only around 40 billion market cap. And then, you know, but yeah, I you know, in a mid cap space, small cap, however you want to define it, I think there's some interesting, whether it's like First Solar, which I think has a secular theme happening. And in addition, it's sort of surrounded by a lot of poorly capitalized competitors. You know, and they are very much best of breed in terms of balance sheet and you know, management and scale. And, you know, and I think if you look at the cost differential, you're looking at an industry that is incredibly becoming very much sort of on par with traditional energy sources, and that's without subsidies and things like that. So yeah, I mean, those are things that are kind of, you know, things that I own and things that I think are very, very interesting and things that are, you know, disrupting, you know, but are sort of best of breed. I think if you look at capacity in renewables, it's around one-fifth of total production right now is in renewables. And I think in 10 years, I think you're going to look at it being about half of the world's generation capacity. And I think sort of as these energy storage costs continue to decline and the build out increases, you know, I just think that, you know, before Mother Nature was such a important component, I think it's going to become less component, you know, storage becomes viable. Yeah, so that's sort of very, very interesting to me. I'm trying to think some other. Yeah, I mean, I've certainly tilted, you know, closer to that space. And, you know, I would agree with you that, you know, certainly this year, high quality small cap has been just a really dead area. And, you know, high quality large cap, you know, on the expensive side has done great. So, you know, it would stand to reason that, you know, that there's more opportunities in that space.
There are also some pockets of the market, some industries that are still quite cheap. Let's say oil and gas, as an example, maybe shipping, or a few others. Do you look at those, or are they just not far enough on the quality spectrum?
So XLE might be an interesting way to play oil and gas. I mean, I've talked to a lot of people in that space, and I think there's two views. I understand as a percent of the S&P, it's gone from 8 to 4. So obviously, I think that's very interesting to me. And I also understand that it has a very large role. And you know, you can't kind of replace capacity overnight, and I understand the dollars to do so. I think what would concern me is that, you know, just getting back to my First Solar thesis, is that, you know, unsubsidized solar generation is now very competitive with conventional generation. So you have, they're not the low cost producer that they weren't once were. And, you know, but with that said, though, I think there's some that are extraordinarily problematic, you know, that are just environmentally problematic, but life's too short to try to time a bounce in coal or something of that sort when you own 15 to 20 companies. I think what I want to do is find a company within that space that is disrupting what I think is, you know, maybe a lot of capital that's tied into, I don't want to say an outdated source of generation, but what I like about First Solar is that they have staying power. It's profitable. They got this huge net cash position. And they have competitors that are kind of operating in the opposite environment, you know, whether it be losses, little scale, you know, net debt, whatever. And so I see a tailwind there. And I see technologies really kind of, you know, making them very competitive with conventional generation. But, you know, with that said, I own Exxon, a little bit of it for certain clients. You know, it's at a 5% yield. It's clearly like out of favor. And, you know, so if you want to own best of breed, I think there's an opportunity there. I just don't know if I want like kind of broad base exposure across the energy sector, given kind of what I think might happen over the next 10 years. I think it's going to lose share, and I think there's a lot of dollars kind of tied up to old sources. So be selective. But it's not lost on me that as a percent of the S&P, it's sort of halved. But that may say more about the overvaluation in the other industries than it does about the inherent cheapness in that particular sector.
We touched on China already. To what extent are you looking outside the US, perhaps in Europe or other places abroad for ideas?
I don't actively, it's a good question. So, yeah, I mean, I know there's a lot of people I respect who are, you know, obviously doing things in India, and so my China exposure is kind of different. It's not like I intended to go there, and, you know, but I do recognize that the story there is in the early innings, and I think it's remarkable, and I think there's certainly certain demographics there that kind of make it interesting. I think my European exposure has always been through US listed companies, you know, and or maybe ADRs that are like Pharma kind of stands out, where you have a lot that are based out of London. You know, and so I guess technically they're European in some sense, but they have, you know, operations all over the place. They're more global than they are European. There's things that come across my desk, and I'll be honest with you, a lot of them come through your publication and things that kind of feed into that, because it's a very global publication, and you have, you know, what one of the biggest assets is that, you know, you have a lot of really talented people tied in from all over the world. I think for me, it comes down to circle of competence, and it comes down to, it has to be something that I really understand and really know, and then I have to kind of get comfortable with what's happening geopolitically and otherwise. And so is my conviction and my knowledge strong enough that I can kind of nudge out, you know, something that's already within, you remember, I only own 15 or 20 positions. So it's got to be so good and so strong that I can kind of move out something. And so I've sort of shied away not in any strategic way. It's just more, I think it's sort of like an opportunity cost. It's like, if I have an idea that's based in the US and you know, maybe they, you know, there's so many global companies to choose from. And we obviously mentioned several of those. And if I understand the competitive environment, you know, I mean, I obviously like GE competes with Siemens, it's duopoly, and, you know, maybe Boeing and Airbus and things like that. So, you know, you have to be kind of mindful of what's happening globally, but I don't actively seek out companies just because they might be connected to a certain area or things like that. And it's more of an opportunity cost. It's like I have the ability in most environments to really carefully select 15 or 20 companies without stretching, you know, what I maybe know or don't know. I try to be just real careful about being intellectually honest with who I am and, you know, where my strengths and weaknesses are. And so for that, I've just never really had a lot of exposure to the URMP companies.
Understood. Well, Glenn, I'll leave it there. I would just encourage our members to feel free to follow up with any further thoughts or questions. It's always a pleasure to catch up with you and get your latest views on the market, what you're seeing, and to always also to learn more about your investment approach. So thank you so much for being with us again this year, and we look forward to another opportunity in the future.
John, pleasure's mine. Thanks so much for having me, and thanks for putting on this great event.
Thanks so much. All the best, and goodbye for now.
Goodbye.